From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russia warns Ukraine of civil war in the southeast, calls for Burma to allow humanitarian aid into Rakhine. Rwanda marks 20 years since the genocide, a new index on the quality of life for young people, and the Peace Corps works to help traditional silk weavers of Madagascar.
They had never really been compensated properly for their work.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the southeastern parts of Ukraine should be included in talks about the country's future. He told reporters today in Moscow that Russia wants to see those regions, which are largely Russian-speaking, represented in multilateral talks. In Paris, NATO chief Anders Fogh Rasmussen warned that further Russian intervention in Ukraine would be a historic mistake that would further isolate Russia from the world. Also today, Russia's foreign ministry called on Ukraine to halt what it called military preparations in the southeast that could lead to civil war. Ukrainian Interior Minister Arsen Avakov said 70 protesters were arrested in an anti-terror operation to drive out pro-Russian demonstrators who seized a government building in the city of Kharkiv. Pro-Russian demonstrators took over buildings Sunday in the Ukrainian cities of Kharkiv, Donetsk, and Luhansk. They are demanding referendums on splitting with Ukraine, the same kind of vote that took place last month in Crimea. The White House has cautioned Russia against military intervention in eastern Ukraine. White House spokesperson Jay Carney.
We're concerned about several escalatory moves in Ukraine over the weekend, and we see those as a result of increased Russian pressure on Ukraine. As you noted, we saw groups of pro-Russian demonstrators take over government buildings in the eastern cities of Kharkiv, Donetsk, and Luhansk. And there is strong evidence suggesting some of these demonstrators were paid and were not local residents.
Carney further cautioned the Kremlin regarding eastern Ukraine.
If Russia moves into eastern Ukraine, either overtly or covertly, this would be a very serious escalation. We call on President Putin and his government to cease all efforts to destabilize Ukraine. And we caution against further military intervention.
The White House spokesperson also added that the U.S. is ready to impose further sanctions against Russia should the situation escalate further. At the U.S. State Department, spokesperson Jennifer Psaki said Secretary of State John Kerry spoke again with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Monday.
He conveyed to Foreign Minister Lavrov that the United States is watching events over the last 24 hours in Kharkiv, Donetsk, Luhansk, and Mariupol with great concern, and noted that these do not appear to be a spontaneous set of events. Rather, the secretary noted the Ukrainian government's assertion that this appeared to be a carefully orchestrated campaign with Russian support.
Psaki also noted that the Secretary of State spoke about ways of getting beyond the current crisis.
Made clear that any further Russian efforts to destabilize Ukraine will incur further costs for Russia, and the ministers also discussed convening direct talks within the next 10 days between Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and the EU to try to de-escalate the tensions.
The State Department spokesperson also said Mr. Kerry agreed to meet with top diplomats from Russia, Ukraine, and the European Union in a new push to calm tensions in eastern Ukraine. Russia has a large force concentrated on the border, but experts say the consequences of such a move could be severe and unpredictable. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
Russia withdrew one unit from its border with Ukraine last week in an apparent gesture to ease tensions. Tens of thousands of troops remain officially participating in an exercise, but it's the kind of exercise that could quickly become something else, according to the commander of NATO's sizable military force, American General Philip Breedlove.
The force that is at the Ukrainian border now to the east is very, very sizable and very, very ready.
And it's facing a much smaller Ukrainian force, including many reservists and new volunteers. NATO forces are relatively far away, like these in Germany, and officials have made clear they do not want to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. It seems that eastern Ukraine, with its large ethnic Russian population, is there for the taking if Russian leaders decide they want it. but it's a large area and difficult to defend. Russia expert Igor Sutyagin of London's Royal United Services Institute does not think an invasion is imminent.
To secure that in tight manner, you need such enormous amount of troops. So it's possible to invade, it's possible to seize some parts of Ukraine, but it's probably impossible to keep them.
At the International Institute for Strategic Studies, retired British Brigadier Ben Barry says Russia could also face other challenges in eastern Ukraine, where the percentage of ethnic Russians is much lower than in Crimea.
There would be the prospect of some sort of long-term Ukrainian people's war, guerrilla movement, terrorism, something that would militarily oppose the occupation by the Russian forces on the long term.
In addition, the international community would likely increase the economic and diplomatic isolation imposed on Russia because of the Crimea takeover. International moves so far have been criticized as weak, but Igor Sutyagin says they're already costing Russia tens of billions of dollars and serve as a significant deterrent to further adventurism.
Economic measures being undertaken by NATO members are much more serious than any sanctions or, military moves.
Experts also say Russia could achieve many of its apparent goals for Ukraine without invading again, including the weakening of the Kyiv government's influence in the east, making the region economically dependent on Russia, and sending a message to NATO not to even consider putting troops on its border. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is warning that the U.S. will defend its Asian allies in the event of any conflict with China. The Pentagon chief made his comments today after meeting in Beijing with his Chinese counterpart, Chang Wanquan. Hagel said, Washington is fully committed to treaties obliging it to protect its longtime allies, Japan and the Philippines. Manila and Tokyo are among several Asian countries that accuse China of using intimidation to advance its maritime claims. Hagel also renewed U.S. criticism of the air defense identification zone set up by China last year that covers islands also claimed by Tokyo. At a joint news conference, Chang stood firm on the Chinese position, vowing Beijing will make no compromise, no concession on the disputes. The U.N. Special Rapporteur for Human Rights to Burma is urging the government to allow foreign aid workers to return to Rakhine State. The workers were evacuated last month because of ethnic unrest. But the UN warns their departure has led to severe consequences for at least 140,000 displaced people living in temporary camps. Gabrielle Palak reports from our bureau in Bangkok.
The UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights to Burma raised alarms this week over a long deteriorating situation in Rakhine State that he warned could amount to crimes against humanity. In Rangoon, UN spokesperson Pierre Perron says time is running out for the 140,000 people displaced by violence who are living in camps.
We have people who will run out of food in the next 2 weeks if we can't distribute food to the camps. We have a peak in the dry season at the moment, and water levels are running very low, and we need to be able to bring water to people who need it. And really, most importantly, people need to have access to health services. And at the moment, emergency health cases are not being referred to the hospitals simply because the NGOs are not there.
For years, international rights groups have criticized government policies that deny the Rohingya citizenship and restrict their travel. In the past 2 years, ethnic and religious tensions have led to violence between the Muslim Rohingya and Buddhist Rakhine communities in Rakhine State. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have fled their homes for temporary camps, where they depend on international aid for survival. Foreign aid groups were forced to leave in March after violent mobs attacked some offices. Tomas Quintana, the UN's Special Rapporteur for Human Rights to Burma, warns an impending humanitarian crisis now looms. This is the second time Quintana has raised the possibility of crimes against humanity in Rakhine State, but Burmese officials contacted by VOA declined to respond to the claim. On Monday, British Foreign Minister Hugo Swire, in a meeting with Burma's ambassador in London, also raised concerns about humanitarian aid. Joseph Fisher is a spokesperson for the British Embassy in Rangoon. He says Swire hopes to urge the government to fully restore humanitarian aid.
As a result of those developments, hundreds of thousands of people in Rakhine State, mainly from the Rohingya community, are not receiving vital medical and humanitarian aid. So the minister, in his discussions with the Burmese ambassador, called on the Burmese government to urgently restore humanitarian access to all communities in need, and to ensure the security of humanitarian aid workers and all communities in Rakhine State.
Last week, U.S. Department of State spokesperson Marie Harf urged the Burmese government to rescind travel restrictions placed on aid workers. Burma claimed these were in place for the safety of aid workers. A government investigation into the attacks in Sitwe was scheduled to present its findings to the president Monday, but the government has yet to announce the commission's findings. This is Gabrielle Pollock reporting from Bangkok for VOA News.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame paid tribute to the victims of the 1994 Rwandan genocide Monday and praised the country's rapid rebuilding over the past 20 years. VOA's Gabe Joselo reports the president also took a swipe at the international community following a diplomatic rift with France.
African heads of state and foreign dignitaries joined commemoration events in the Rwandan capital, beginning with a ceremony to light the national flame of mourning at the Kigali Genocide Memorial. April 7th marks the day 20 years ago when ethnic Hutu militias began a killing rampage, targeting Tutsis and moderate Hutus who would not take part in the slaughter. Some 800,000 people were killed within 100 days. President Kagame honored the victims at a memorial event at Kigali's Amahoro Stadium.
As we pay tribute to the victims, both the living and those who have passed, we also salute the unbreakable Rwandan spirit to which we owe the survival and renewal of our country.
Thousands of people filled stadium seats to watch speeches, performances, and a video to commemorate the anniversary. Shouts and wails could be heard throughout the crowd as some became overwhelmed with emotion. Handlers dispersed in the stands helped soothe those who had become distraught. Current and former leaders from around the world also turned out for the occasion, but France withdrew its delegation in protest over comments from President Kagame, accusing France of having a role in the planning and execution of the genocide. France has long denied the claims. France was the Rwandan government's main Western backer before the genocide and trained its Hutu-dominated army. While not directly mentioning the dispute, Mr. Kagame said Rwandans will continue to seek concrete explanations for the genocide.
People cannot be bribed or forced into changing their history. And no country is powerful enough, even when they think they are, to change the facts.
The international community has been criticized for not doing enough to prevent the genocide despite numerous warnings. Speaking at the memorial event, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon acknowledged these shortcomings.
Many United Nations personnel and others showed remarkable bravery, but we could have done much more. We should have done much more.
Mr. Bond said the international community still has more to learn from the lessons of Rwanda, noting the failure to stop the conflicts in Central African Republic and in Syria. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Kigali.
The international U.S. service organization, the Peace Corps, is working in Madagascar to help local silk weavers expand their business and provide a steady income. The effort is aimed at helping the current traditional Malaxi weavers, as well as generations to come. Former Peace Corps volunteer Natalie Mundy worked on the project for 2 years.
I was placed there in 2010 as the second Peace Corps volunteer. to find a market abroad for a federation of silk weavers in Madagascar. They weave an endemic silk that's only found there in Madagascar, and it's their livelihood. But they've never, before 2010, they had never had access to an international market, so they had never really been compensated properly for their work, and that was the purpose of the project.
And what market did you find for them?
I originally just kind of dabbled in a couple of things where I'm from, in Roanoke, Virginia, and I sent some things to my parents, and they sent it around. I took it home when I went home and sold it to anyone I could think of. But then after about 9 months of that, I found the San Fe International Folk Art Market in San Fe, New Mexico, which is the largest folk art market in the world. And we have attended that for 3 years now. And the first year was really a huge financial gain for the cooperative, and kind of was able to let people know what goes on in Madagascar other than what the movies portray and everything, and it was very exciting for everyone.
Other than the lemurs jumping around, I guess.
Yeah.
When you say it was a lot of money for these people, about how much are we talking?
So I'd have to just double check my numbers to make sure I don't say something wrong, but $32,000 around about for the first year, and then we've increased it 10% each year, and in 2013 we made about $42,000. It's a 2.5-day market. So it's quite a lot of inventory to be selling in that amount of time because our price points are not so high. So we really clear a lot of scarves in that amount of time.
And what do they use the money for, the women back in Madagascar?
Yeah, this is the amazing part. I was just back there to do research for my thesis, which I'm finishing up right now. And I did about 60 hours of interviews. So I really was able to learn a lot about what's happened in the 2 years since I've been gone. And It's fascinating, and it's a great story to tell. They've used it to save for their children's school fees, so they can pay in advance to send their kids to school. But about 90% of them have changed their kids from studying at public schools to private schools because they can afford that now. And 8 of their kids are now studying in college, so that also they weren't able to afford that before. A lot of them are older and widowed and at times sick, so they can pay for the medicine that's needed and any kind of medical care. They have restructured their houses. Either they've added on to make their houses safer, or they've built new houses from scratch, which is a really big deal for them because a lot of their houses are dilapidated and the rain comes through or part of it's falling down or something. And socially, it doesn't look good, but obviously it's not safe either. So they've done a lot of that, which is impressive. But they save for the first time. I think the most I heard was about $5,000 to $6,000 U.S. dollars of savings that the silk weavers have. And they opt to not even touch that, as if we wouldn't touch it here in the States either. They earn the money and they continue to put it in the bank and they don't touch it. They just live off of what they make month to month and they continue to save, which is a huge deal.
Former Peace Corps volunteer Natalie Mundy, now back from Madagascar in New York.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
A new tool has been released to measure and compare the quality of life for young people in 30 nations. The Center for Strategic and International Studies and the International Youth Foundation say the Global Youth Well-Being Index represents nearly 70% of the world's youth population. We asked the director of the study, Nicole Golden, what exactly is the Global Youth Well-Being Index?
It is really a first of its kind effort to bring together 40 previously rather disparate data points on young people's lives to bring them together in a way that allows policymakers, young people, public and private donors to get a sense of how young people are doing, how they're feeling about their quality of life, in order to take some actions and improve the well-being of young people around the world.
How do you collect and disseminate the data?
So the data that we utilize in the index is from a number of public as well as independent, if you will, data sets and data collectors. So whether it's groups like the World Bank, the International Labor Organization, various United Nations organizations that collect data, as well as collaborating with, as I said, a couple of, call them independent data collectors, such as a group called True Insight, part of the Futures Group that conducts a number of global youth surveys worldwide. So we bring together those data points, and we built our framework, if you will, the framework of 40 indicators that are housed or fall into six different, we call them domains or buckets of young people's lives. And we bring them together and through a kind of mathematical and analytical exercise, calculate and aggregate the overall index score, which is what drives the placements, the rankings of the 30 countries, as well as the scores within each of these different six areas.
Well, you mentioned it. What are the highest and lowest rated countries in youth well-being?
You got it. So the number one country in our index is Australia. And in 30th place of the countries that we include is Nigeria. And if I can just touch on that for 1 second, we don't want to imply that countries that aren't included in our index have necessarily low or high well-being for their young people. We made some strategic choices based on data available as well as, you know, data consistency and credibility, as well as to ensure that we had good geographic as well as income level in terms of the country's income level representation. So that's where we came up with the 30 countries that we include. And as I said, Australia tops the ranks in the overall, and Nigeria comes in 30th.
Well, what is it about Australia that you like so much?
Well, it's not what we like so much. It's you know, what the data tells us. But really, they come out strong in really all of the indicators. You know, most of the indicators in across the domain. So, you know, Australia is interesting because, as I said, they have relatively high performance in each of the six domains that gives them this top ranking score. For example, they top the ranks of the 30. They're number one in education specifically, and coming in number two in health, and number four in economic opportunity. So several of the other high performing countries in that top 10 overall, Sweden, South Korea, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the U.S., do well again overall, but may fall in one of the particular areas, whereas Australia shows the most consistent performance. And as well, on the youth outlook indicators in particular, they have relatively consistent optimism shown and displayed by its young people.
Nicole Golden, Director of the Youth Prosperity and Security Initiative for the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the International Youth Foundation. Wednesday on International Edition, we ask what was lacking in Nigeria that it got the lowest ranking. The Connecticut Huskies defeated the Kentucky Wildcats 60-54 to win the U.S. Men's College Basketball Championship in Dallas, Texas. The Huskies led from the start, pushing their lead to 15 at one point in the first half of the National Collegiate Athletic Association title game. But Kentucky, which started five freshmen, staged a furious comeback and trailed Connecticut 35-31 at the half. The Wildcats closed to within 1 point midway in the second half, but missed numerous free throws at critical times that would have given them the lead. The championship is Connecticut's fourth title since 1999 and comes 1 year after the NCAA banned the Huskies from the annual tournament because of a poor graduation rate. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. April 8th is the day celebrated by many Buddhists as the birthday of Gautama Buddha, the founder of their religion. Tradition holds that Buddha was born as Siddhartha Gautama more than 2,500 years ago in what is present-day Nepal. In 1730, Sherith Israel, the first Jewish synagogue in America, was dedicated in New York City. On this day in 1935, the U.S. Congress passed the Emergency Relief Appropriations Act, granting President Franklin D. Roosevelt's request for nearly $5 billion to fund the Works Progress Administration, the largest relief program in American history. The program was created to relieve the suffering of millions due to the effects of the Great Depression. In 1945, noted anti-Nazi pastor and theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer was condemned to death by a judge in Germany shortly before the end of World War II. Bonhoeffer, who was part of a conspiracy against Adolf Hitler, was hanged the next day. On this day in 1953, the leader of the Kenyan independence movement, Jomo Kenyatta, was convicted of involvement in extremist violence against white settlers and sentenced to 7 years in prison at hard labor. In 1963, Kenya won its independence, and in 64, Kenyatta was elected president. On the evening of April 8, 1974, Hank Aaron broke one of baseball's most coveted records, hitting his 715th home run. He thus broke the 39-year-old record set by baseball great Babe Ruth. In 2013, Britain's first female prime minister, Margaret Thatcher, died of a stroke. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late March, as part of the U.S. government's drive toward gender equality and global elimination of gender-based violence, or GBV, the Department of State, working through its Bureau for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, introduced the Gender-Based Violence Emergency Response and Protection Initiative. This program aims to provide immediate financial assistance for survivors of severe gender-based violence, as well as for those who find themselves under threat of imminent attack due to their gender or gender identity. This is a first-of-its-kind global program dedicated to aiding survivors of extreme forms of gender-based violence everywhere. The network will be funded by the State Department and run by a consortium of non-governmental organizations. Those organizations include Vital Voices Global Partnership, ProMundo U.S., the International Organization for Migration, and the American Bar Association Rule of Law Initiative. The new Gender-Based Violence Emergency and Protection Initiative builds on and complements past U.S. efforts to eliminate gender-based violence, said U.S. Deputy Secretary Robert Burns. It has three clear objectives. First, survivors of gender-based violence will help receive urgent support, like immediate medical help, emergency shelter, psychosocial support, and legal assistance. Second, the program will provide targeted training for governments and civil society on GBV-related laws and advocacy. These trainings support men and women working to put an end to gender-based violence. And finally, all partners in the initiative will work to develop a regional and international network of service providers and activists in 11 country hubs. From Mexico to Mali and Tajikistan to Thailand, these networks will share data, lessons learned, and best practices, coordinate emergency responses, and work together on shared advocacy efforts, said Deputy Secretary Burns.
Gender-based violence is an inexcusable crime and an affront to dignity and human rights. It robs people, disproportionately women and girls, of their potential and threatens their mental, physical, and reproductive health. It denies economic opportunity and undermines economic growth. And it imperils the safety and stability of communities and of countries.
To make a lasting impact, he said, we need to match the scope of this challenge with the intensity of our response. It will require each and every one of us to stay focused, to continue to marry words with deeds, and to never be content with cheering from the sidelines when we can join the global effort to end the epidemic of gender-based violence once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.